Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thick black oil has hit delicate Louisiana marshlands. The U.S. is conferring with Cuba about the spill's projected path. BP's tip line for suggestions on containing the spill is getting hundreds of calls, including one from actor Kevin Costner, who's invested in a $24 million oil and water separator. BP has 70 people, by the way, manning the hotline, but callers say they're not being taken seriously. And top marine biologists are also asking to be heard. Yesterday, marine biologists testifying on Capitol Hill said agencies like the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration should do more to crack down on BP. Former NOAA lead scientist and oceanographer Sylvia Earle told us the U.S. should know how much oil there is.
That's just absurd that we don't know. Sure, it's a priority, as BP points out, to stop the flow, but while you're at it, you need to know how much is coming out so you can gauge the problem and gauge the avenues taken to solve the problem. How much dispersant should be applied if you've got X amount of oil coming out should have been one of the criteria for using dispersants at all. I was asked yesterday during the congressional testimony whether tests had been made on the impact of the dispersants on marine wildlife. And, you know, I'm hard-pressed to provide a specific answer, except to know that no tests have been done on creatures who live at 5,000 feet, 4,000 feet, 3,000 feet, 1,000 feet, and yet the expectation is that oil magically seems to disappear, then the problem disappears. That's where the problems begin.
Meanwhile, to Louisiana, Jeffrey Ball of the Wall Street Journal joins us from New Orleans. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal toured the coast yesterday. He said, "The day we've been fearing is upon us." Can you describe what's happening along the coast?
What's happened now is that quite a lot of oil is starting to wash ashore in an area of southeastern Louisiana called Plaquemines Parish, particularly. This is where the Mississippi River empties into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's essentially a finger of land and marsh that sticks down into the Gulf, and it's that finger that sort of catches some of this spill. Until a few days ago, the reports of oil washing ashore were essentially limited to kind of discs of oil. I actually saw some of this and touched some of this a couple of days ago. They're sort of dime-sized bits of oil that have the consistency and color of melted chocolate. It's almost as if a Hershey's Kiss were melted, and that's kind of what this looks like. What's happening now is very different. Essentially, waves of thick oil are washing into the marshes. It's important to remember that these marshes are extremely ecologically fragile. They're ecologically significant, and they're also, in this part of the country, extremely economically significant.
Well, so that's onshore. Offshore, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is saying today that there's going to be a dynamic kill on Sunday. A top kill is another phrase that we're hearing. What is that?
Just as context, I mean, there have been a variety of things that have been attempted to stop the flow of oil from this well. What separates this oil spill from others is that this isn't just a finite oil spill. This is a continuous oil spill, day after day, week after week. A number of things have been tried, and what they're now trying is essentially to block up the well. The ultimate solution, everyone seems to say, is the drilling of what's called a relief well. In fact, two wells into the sea floor near the existing one that's leaking, and the idea is that those will be, BP says, a relatively surefire way to stop, to relieve the pressure on the well that's leaking and therefore stop the flow of oil. The problem with that is that that's going to take probably 2 months, people say.
We understand this dynamic kill, this top kill. The idea is to just pour mud on top of the gushing well underwater and then cap it off with cement. But it's something that's it's common above ground, but it's something that's never been tried this deep at sea?
Well, that's right. And this is the latest in a string of things for which that description is true here at the spill. We were talking a moment ago about the application of chemicals called dispersants. Dispersants have been used in oil spills before. What's different about this spill is the quantity in which they're being sprayed by airplanes on the surface of the slick, and also the fact that they're being injected at the sea floor by robots, which is raising all sorts of environmental questions. And just as that application at the sea floor is unprecedented, so is the technique that you described. I mean, it's important to remember that the fact of the depth of this spill and the continuing nature of it is really something that the oil industry has never encountered before.
Well, meanwhile, you talk about the gallons still gushing. There's questions as to how much that is. Massachusetts Representative Ed Markey has asked BP to make public the live feed of the oil spill, the underwater cameras. Interior Secretary Salazar says now that the government has access to that video, scientists can use it to check estimates on how much is coming out a day. But now we're hearing that even the estimates that said that BP was way underestimating, even those estimates are now wrong, that it's way over even those critical estimates.
Well, the estimates of the amount of oil coming out of this well have increased over time. BP has said that it really does not know. And the reason that it does not know, it says, is that this well was drilled to be what's called an exploration well, not a production well. And as a result of the fact that it was an exploration well, there were not flow meters put on the well to assess the amount of oil that's coming out. And so that's why the world is left with scientists trying to assess video to figure out how much oil is coming out. And it's worth noting that lots of scientists are engaging in this, and many of them are coming up with varying estimates. People have said, BP and the authorities have said so far, that it doesn't much matter how much oil is coming out. They're putting on a full court press to try to stop this thing, and they wouldn't really be doing anything different if it were a number of times more than the latest official estimate. There are others, though, who say that if, in fact, there's a lot more oil than the estimates currently suggest, then that suggests potentially graver environmental damage both at sea and on shore.
Jeffrey Ball of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Sure.
Senate Democrats will try again today to move a sweeping financial regulation bill forward after failing to find enough votes yesterday. Financial reform is also an issue on the other side of the Atlantic, where that debt crisis in Greece could take down the euro and the American economy. We want to start, though, in Washington with Binyamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The New York Times. And Binyamin, yesterday's no votes on financial reform included two Democrats, Maria Cantwell of Oregon and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. Both didn't think the bill was tough enough. But Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid seemed most irritated with Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. He said Brown had given his word that he'd vote for the bill, but changed his mind. Why? Why did Brown change his mind?
Well, Brown said that he changed his mind because he wants the Senate to consider revising a provision that would prohibit large financial firms from basically managing their own investment portfolios. Brown said that he wants to carve an exception out of that rule for mutual fund companies and insurance companies, two kinds of companies that Massachusetts has in spades. So he described it as an issue of protecting home state industries.
Right. I just want to back up a second, because this is referring to the so-called Volcker Rule. It's a limited version of Glass-Steagall. This is the law that was overturned in the late 90s that used to separate banks. So explain, you know, why this thinking in this bill would impact insurance companies. What would it's supposed to be aimed at Wall Street, but what impact would it have?
Right. So commercial banking and Wall Street trading used to be separated by law. That barrier came down in 1999, and this law, for the most part, does not put that barrier back up. But the one thing it does do is say that banks, commercial banks, cannot engage in what's called proprietary trading, which basically means trading for their own profit, not in the interest of their customers, just, you know, pursuing their own investments on the side. That rule is written in a way that it could be read to apply to all of the financial institutions that would come under this new set of regulations, including not just traditional banks, but perhaps mutual fund companies, insurance companies, other types of financial institutions that might end up being regulated under this new law.
Yeah.
And so it would prevent them from engaging in that kind of activity as well.
Well, by the way, Maria Cantwell, who I misplaced, I moved her to Oregon. She's, of course, from Washington. She's teamed up with Senator John McCain on a proposal to reinstate the Glass-Steagall law, the one that separated commercial from investment banking. We always say it's like In a Wonderful Life, where your mortgage stayed in your local bank and then Wall Street gambled with investment money. And her amendment hasn't come up for a vote yet. Is that why she's unhappy with the bill? That, you know, she's the opposite of Scott Brown. She wants to go further with regulation.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. That was Russ Feingold, the other Democrat who voted against it. That is his issue with the bill. But Maria Cantwell said yesterday that her concern is actually that the restrictions on trading in derivatives are not sufficiently stringent. So you've got kind of a range of concerns here, a bunch of people who are sufficiently dissatisfied with the present shape of the legislation to prevent it from moving forward.
Well, in fact, we're going to be talking about how in Europe there's a move to make regulations more stringent. Tell us, you know, remind us, the derivatives, these were the mortgage bonds that were traded in sort of this murky world where nobody really knew what was in what. What is she asking for? What's not there?
Yeah, these are kind of the second cousins of mortgage bonds. These are financial instruments that are derived from mortgage bonds or from other assets. It's a way of betting on the movement of other prices. And much of that betting now happens essentially in the dark between private parties who don't report what they're doing to anyone. And as a consequence, a lot of bets can build up in the system without regulators knowing that that's happening. So this law essentially would require most of that trading to move onto public exchanges so it can be observed and tracked and quantified. And it would require much of that trading to take place through what are called clearinghouses, which are essentially third parties that validate that the two parties who are making the trade, you know, have the money that they say they have and are writing the contract that they say they're writing. And Cantwell's concern is that the law, because of the way it's written, would not actually require that to happen. That there's a loophole in it, basically, that would not require all of those trades to move into this new system.
Are these the synthetic collateral debt obligations? What are these things?
They are awfully complicated financial instruments, but their essence is that they are ways for people to bet on the performance of other assets, on whether a loan will be paid or not, on whether a stock will go up and down in price, on whether wheat will be worth $50 3 months from now. It is a way for the financial markets to make bets on the future.
Aha. Are these the credit default swaps?
Yeah, for example, although not only credit default swaps, but that is an example of a derivative.
So that is still much debated in reform. But just real briefly, the bill also covers a wide range of lenders, not just banks, small businesses like auto dealerships, department stores that extend credit, payday lenders. Where's the debate on that kind of regulation?
The administration has pushed very hard for this legislation to create this new Consumer Financial Protection Agency that would have authority to guard against abuses of borrowers by a wide range of lenders. And they've been very determined that this should apply not just to banks, but as you said, to mortgage lenders, auto dealers, department stores. Anyone who makes loans to customers on a large scale would basically be covered by the bill in its present form. The House passed a version of this bill that exempts auto dealers from these requirements, and there is a movement in the Senate to do the same thing. Auto dealers are a pretty powerful lobbying force, and they view themselves as not having been the source of the financial crisis, and they don't want to be hit with new regulation. That still needs to be sorted out.
What is your sense of how this bill moves forward in just the couple seconds we have?
You know, the Senate usually gets its way these days. The way it works in Washington is if you can get a bill through the Senate, it usually stays in that form.
Benjamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The New York Times, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
When we come back, speaking of those credit default swaps, did they play a part in the fall of Greece, or at least did U.S. investors benefit when Greece fell? And how will demands from Europe for reform be heard across the Atlantic? We're going to speak with Richard Parker, a professor of public policy at Harvard, in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about financial regulation on both sides of the Atlantic. German Chancellor Angela Merkel made a strong push for financial reform today, saying it needs to be coordinated among major economies. In the background, worries about the stability of the euro, the European Union, and, of course, the debt crisis in Greece continues to spiral. 20,000 people marched in Athens today. Richard Parker is a professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's author of several books and is an advisor to the Greek government. And, Richard, just give us the thumbnail, because we've mentioned this before, but you talk about the debt crisis in Greece as being this smallish problem that metastasized in part because of U.S. speculators.
That's right. I mean, what happened was that last fall a new government came to power. It discovered that its deficit was much larger than the previous government had said it was, and it had to go out and start borrowing more heavily. Well, the markets couldn't really determine how bad the Greek situation was, so they started pricing up those bonds higher and higher. But in a situation in which the market's really uncertain of the underlying issues, it tends to build risk premiums in. So it kept the rates that Greece could borrow at kept going higher and higher. And Wall Street kept probing and probing and probing, looking for weakness in the Greek financial structure, fiscal structure, in order to bet on the future direction of the value of those bonds and interest rates.
These are these credit default swaps.
Credit default swaps, exactly.
They were
exactly.
betting, as much as they bet the mortgage bonds would fail, they were betting that Greece would fail and they'd collect big time after these insurance policies they took out. But, you know, we've been talking about reform, and we've been told by economists that credit default swaps are an important counterbalance in an economy. You know, they're supposed to send the signal out that things aren't well. They're a necessary tension. You say what? What did these credit default swaps do?
You know, it's like my parents' view of alcohol when I was growing up as a teenager. A little bit won't hurt you. A little more is probably good for you. Too much will kill you and a lot of other people if you're not careful. And that's what the credit default problem, swap problem is. In an utterly unregulated, completely opaque environment, nobody really knows what other parties are up to. It's like a college fraternity party on steroids. And
How did this impact Europe?
Well, it's enormous because what happens is Greece is a relatively small economy. It's only 2% of Europe. And people in on Wall Street and in the city in London don't know the intricacies of Greek finance, don't know the intricacies of the Greek economy. So they're subject to being stampeded. So the people who were placing bets against the Greek economy by putting credit default swaps on Greek bonds in the market then begin a kind of rumor mongering on the street that says, oh, by the way, did you know that Greece won't be able to make its payments next month? Oh, did you hear? And that moves with the speed of lightning in a nervous market like the one we're in today, which is just barely recovering from the meltdown of 2 years ago.
So people start fleeing from the bonds. The bonds become worthless. The Greek bonds become worthless. The sort of the self-fulfilling wish of the investors as they collapse.
It's the coyote stampeding the cattle and then going, wow, look, the cattle are stampeding.
Right, and of course the credit default swaps come due and pay off.
Make billions. Make billions for the...
So what, Angela Merkel, others calling for reform connected to U.S. reform? We just heard from Benjamin that... Benjamin Applebaum, I should say, that there's resistance to making the derivatives, making these kinds of financial instruments transparent. There's resistance to regulation.
Of course there's resistance to regulation coming from Wall Street, and Wall Street has got its hands all over key members of the Senate. The Wall Street community was the largest donor to the Congress in the last cycle after the lawyers as a group, and many of those lawyers were working for Wall Street firms. This will be a constraint on the most powerful firms operating on the street. When you talk about a lot of the regulations like too big to fail banks or separating investment bank from commercial banks, which is this so-called Glass-Steagall issue, this doesn't affect all 5,000 U.S. banks. This affects 10 of the 5,000 U.S. banks. But they're already behemoths. And the fact is that TARP actually created new behemoths. Goldman Sachs, which had been an investment bank, chose to take on TARP money by turning itself into a federally government-insured commercial bank. This is insane from the point of view of the risk-taking that they're involved with.
But bring us back to Greece and Europe and the euro. And
sure.
What do you foresee? I mean, you know, maybe what you think should happen, but then also what is more probable will happen to have some kind of international reform.
Well, I think a couple of things. One, as recently as a week ago, the smart money on Wall Street was saying, oh, the Europeans will never get their act together. What this cannon fire from Berlin is today is Angela Merkel suddenly playing the role of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and calling for systemic and international reform of financial markets. Because as a European, she recognizes that single nation reform is doomed to fail. If she prohibits a certain kind of activity in Germany and the continent goes along with them, but a financial firm can carry out that very same activity from New York and it affects the European markets, she's accomplished nothing in terms of local regulation. It's like putting a fence up on one corner of the beach while the sharks are outside swimming offshore. You've got to fence off the entire beach if you're going to actually make everyone safe. And so she's doing two things. She's calling for two things. tightening the level of regulation, and also making sure that it's coordinated on an international basis.
Well, and just I got to ask you one thing, because here you are an advisor to Greece.
Sure.
Some might say you're letting your client off the hook a little too easily. Europeans are complaining that the hardworking Northern Europeans, and this is their words, are being forced to subsidize their less hardworking Mediterranean cousins. Your sense of that argument that, wait a second, maybe it's Greece who should pay more than they even are with all the cutbacks there.
Greece is already paying more than the going rate for bonds in Europe. It's willing to pay 6% and 7%, which it has been doing already. You have to understand, this is not a bailout in the sense that they're getting a grant. All they're getting is the ability to borrow at a commercially viable rate. And they're still going to have to pay all this money back, and they fully intend to do so.
Richard Parker, professor of public policy at Harvard, also author of several books, one of them John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics, by the way. Professor Parker, commenting on the international push for reform. Thanks so much.
Delighted.
We'll be back after the latest news here and now. The Pakistani government today blocked access to YouTube because of what it called sacrilegious content. It's part of a growing crackdown against internet sites thought to be offensive to the country's majority Muslim population. Yesterday, the government asked internet service providers to block access to Facebook because of a page on the social networking site that encourages users to post caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The page Everybody Draw Muhammad Day was in reaction to the protests against the creators of the animated TV series South Park. Remember, they claimed Muhammad was in a bear suit during an episode earlier this year. The BBC's Alim Makbul reports.
These are protests in Pakistan because of something someone thousands of miles away posted on the Facebook website. It invites people to draw and send in pictures of the Prophet Muhammad. The response at these angry but sporadic demonstrations has been directed, some would say misdirected, at the social networking site as a whole.
The event that was organized by Facebook is such a cowardly act that we are here to protest against it.
In an internet cafe in Peshawar, the web users all told us they were Facebook members. Now they're unable to access the popular site at all. The High Court here has told all internet service providers to block Facebook across the country with immediate effect.
It's totally wrong that there is a group like this trying to hurt Muslims, but you shouldn't just ban the whole of Facebook.
I think Facebook should be banned because if their administration is not taking action about this competition, it should be banned.
In spite of many complaints, the lawyers who demanded Facebook be banned remain pleased with the outcome. Fidar Gul is one of the members of the Islamic Lawyers Movement.
The whole website maybe are not against the Muslim community, but just the portion in which the sketches are there shown and which is against the Muslim community and against our Prophet. So we want to ban that portion, but if it is not possible to ban that portion of the website, not to show the sketches and drawing. So we were constrained but to file this petition to ban the entire website in Pakistan.
But the move has dismayed many here, particularly those who've been monitoring the government's actions in Pakistani cyberspace of late. They include Reba Shahid, the editor of Spider Internet magazine.
There was a blanket ban on Blogspot for the very same reasons in early 2005 when Pakistan Telecommunication Authority was trying to censor the website as in prevent the access of offensive Muhammad cartoons.
And these protests in Pakistan now will also remind people of the ones in response to those now infamous drawings. And the new Facebook case is of a type we're likely to see time and again in the future as boundaries are pushed further. Well, you won't find many people in Pakistan who say they agree with competitions like this in which caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad are involved. But what there is debate about is how to handle things when issues like this arise. Because there are many now wondering if a site like Facebook can be banned in this way, what sites will be next?
That report from the BBC's Alim Makbul in Pakistan. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to have a conversation with one of our favorite guests, Bruce Feiler, the Walking the Bible guy. He recently discovered that he had cancer. He wondered, if I die, what will my 3-year-old twin daughters remember about me?
I just had this whole series of thoughts in those very early hours of the art projects I wouldn't mess up and the boyfriends I wouldn't scowl at and the aisles I wouldn't walk down. And a couple days later, I awoke with this idea of how I might give the girls my voice.
The idea? A Council of Dads, a group of Bruce's closest friends who would become his voice for his girls. He's going to talk to us about that tomorrow. Just want to give you a heads up on that. Before we go today, children of illegal immigrants speak out. That's in a bit, Here and Now. First Lady Michelle Obama was visiting an elementary school in Silver Spring, Maryland yesterday when a second grader said she had a question from her mom.
What's her question?
My mom said that Barack Obama's taking everybody away that doesn't pass papers.
Yeah, well, that's something that we have to work on, right? To make sure that people can be here with the right kind of papers, right? That's exactly right. Yeah, well, we have to work on that. We have to fix that.
Again, the little girl said her mom believes the president was taking away people who don't have papers, and her mom doesn't have papers. Many of the country's estimated 11 million illegal immigrants were children who were brought here by their parents. On Monday, several of them held a sit-in at Republican Senator John McCain's Arizona office. Wearing caps and gowns, the college grads were pushing for the DREAM Act, which would provide a path to citizenship for them and possibly in-state tuition. Three of them, face deportation hearings after being detained. 26-year-old Tanya Unzueta was at the sit-in, but left before immigration authorities showed up. She came to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 10 and went on to graduate from the University of Illinois, and she joins us now. Tanya, your thoughts first on that second grader we just heard. Now, we don't know if she is in the U.S. illegally. She could have been born here in the States. But her concern about her mom was pretty palpable. Did that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think that a lot of undocumented young people, including children, live every day in fear, not just of themselves being deported if they're undocumented, but of our parents. I know that I have heard so often from even my citizen friends about what it's like to grow up feeling like you don't know whether your parent is going to come home or not from work, right? Either one of them or both of them. And so it is definitely something that resonates with our communities.
Well, and what we hear on the flip side, a lot of kids who are illegal immigrants because of being brought here to the States don't know that and don't find that out till after they graduate and find out they don't have green cards and they can't get employment.
Correct. And you know, sometimes even if you know that you're undocumented, you don't know exactly what it means in the United States. I knew that we came to the U.S. We didn't have residency or citizenship, but it didn't really hit me exactly what it meant until I graduated from high school and I was trying to go to college. And it was precisely when my school counselor asked me, do you have a green card and how do you expect to go to college, that I realized, wow, like, these are some of the big limitations around being undocumented.
Well, I just want to ask you something because I'm sure people might be thinking of it. We just again heard this little girl. Stephen Camerata of the Center for Immigration Studies told the Atlantic Journal Constitution that people who are for things that are in the DREAM Act use young people, such as yourself, as a political prop because, you know, Americans might have more sympathy for you or that second grader. Are you being used?
No, I am not. One of the great things about our action on Monday is that it was completely youth-led. This is a movement that's led by undocumented young people, and we're not doing it because anyone is telling us to do it or because people think that we're a good image. We're doing it because it's fighting for our lives. I mean, I have grown up in the United States all of my life. I feel like the U.S. is my country. I've learned about the history of the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the immigrant rights movement, the farm workers' rights movement in the United States as part of my growing up here and as part of knowing what the heritage of this country is. And so that's where I've learned to fight for my rights.
Well, Tanya, let's talk more about what you were fighting for in that sit-in in McCain's office, the DREAM Act. What is the DREAM Act? Why are you pushing for it?
The DREAM Act would provide a path to citizenship for undocumented people who came here before the age of 16 and have finished 2 years of college or 2 years in the military and have also shown good character.
But some would say that that's, you know, amnesty in effect. And the DREAM Act also allows the states to give illegal immigrants in-state tuition. Can you understand the anger of people who feel that that puts you, in essence, in line ahead of their kids?
You know, I would say that part of the disconnect is that they see us as this other, right? The immigrant is someone different from their children. And the reality is that we're not. Honestly, when we were sitting in McCain's office, one of the things that the policeman said to us was, wow, you look exactly like my children. You look exactly like the young people that I know. And so, you know, when people talk about, oh, us being ahead of their children, the way that I see it is all we want is an equal opportunity, just like every other American child that lives in the United States.
Well, it's kind of, it raises so many questions because, remember, you were in Arizona, and this is a policeman who's been newly charged with arresting you, although, you know, that the power, he doesn't have that power until July when that new law goes in effect. But what about the concern that if you and others are given this path to citizenship, it would encourage more parents to cross the border illegally to bring their children here so that they get that same path?
People have been crossing the border for a really long time. My parents came to the U.S. because in Mexico we couldn't find a job, and my dad was actually offered a job by someone in the United States. People come here knowing that it's going to be hard, and it's actually the U.S. that pulls people in, at least in my experience.
Well, let me ask you just one last quick question. We know you're a founder of Immigrant Youth Justice League. You helped a lot of kids come out publicly last March. You were in the sit-in in McCain's office. Been very brave. You did, however, leave McCain's office before the immigration authorities came, and the others were taken into custody. Three of them faced deportation hearings back in their home courts. Why did you leave?
I left because it was a group decision that we made around having a spokesperson who was also undocumented be on the outside and be able to tell exactly what the story is of what happened inside. I have to say that it was a very hard decision for me because we'd all been getting ready to be arrested, to face deportation, and to leave my friends in the office was a really hard feeling. But part of the reason why I've been so open about being undocumented is because I really believe that I haven't done anything wrong, that I am not a criminal. I hate the word illegal because we are not illegal people. The immigration violation is actually a civil thing. It's not something criminal. I really have trust that in the end, the United States will also do the right thing.
Your mother wasn't so happy with this.
At first, my mom was a little hesitant, but it wasn't so much because she was scared or didn't want me to talk about it. I mean, I think that we all grow up with this fear of saying that we're undocumented precisely because we are made to feel like we are criminals. So my mother was telling me, you know, you're not a criminal. Being undocumented doesn't define your identity. But what I was telling her was that it actually does. You know, I've grown up more of my life living undocumented than as a Mexican citizen. And so everything in terms of school, in terms of traveling, in terms of my own identity and my own limitations has to do with being undocumented.
That's 26-year-old Tania Unzueta, who took a part in a sit-in this week in Senator John McCain's office to push for passage of the DREAM Act, a path to citizenship for other children who were brought to the United States by illegal immigrant parents and so have the same status. Tania, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And a quick related note, today an Arizona utility regulator warned Los Angeles officials that he might cut off power because the LA City Council voted to boycott Arizona in response to that new immigration law. It could be an empty threat, though. It turns out federal regulators actually decide where the power goes, but we'll follow that story for you. When we come back, what it takes to be an audiobook narrator. That's in 1 minute, here and now. In 1952, poet Dylan Thomas recorded for posterity this famous work.
Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night.
Dylan Thomas reading Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night in 1952. It marked the birth of the books on tape phenomenon, and today audiobooks range from autobiographies to educational texts to raging romance novels.
His tongue tempted hers, then retreated, then slipped through her parted lips again to torment and savor. For a moment, Morgan feared she would faint for a second time in his arms.
Be still my heart, narrator Gail Hendricks reading an excerpt from Nora Roberts' The Right Path. This has become a huge industry. According to the nonprofit Audio Publishers Association, annual sales are over $1 billion. One in four Americans listened to an audiobook in 2008. And second to the words, the most important component is the narrator. Walter Dixon is a colleague of ours at WBUR here in Boston. We don't see him much anymore, though, because he has joined the ranks of audiobook narrators. Walter, it would seem a simple task. You read a book out loud. You tell a story. Is it that simple?
Well, actually, you sort of nailed it on the head when you said tell a story, because first and foremost, that's really what's most important. You know, some people think is, oh, do you have to do a perfect character voice or make people think that you've got five other actors in the studio with you? And you don't, because if you think about it, when you're with your friends and you're sitting around the table telling a story, you don't perfectly imitate your boss or your mom or your coworkers. You just tell the story of what happened well enough that everyone gets it.
Well, but we're going to hear that there are some challenges. And just staying with, you know, the sound, if there's a female voice, do you try to sound like the female voice? Or a child, do you try to be the child?
Well, there's a bear trap. I mean, there are some narrators that will go into a falsetto. I can't imagine listening to Gone with the Wind and hearing, as God is my witness, I will never go hungry again. It's distracting. And really, that's sort of what, at least in my mind, is the guide, is don't distract from the story. So for a woman's voice, I might go up a little bit, but I won't, you know, do something that makes you go, what is this?
Yeah.
Or with celebrities, you know, if Carl Sagan pops up quoted in a physics book, I'm not going to go, a billion years ago, the world was created, because it's distracting.
Right. Well, tell us how you do prepare to do an audio book. For instance, do you read the entire book before you record?
You really have to, especially if it's fiction. If the story's about, let's say, someone who's very meek and then finds themselves, you want to convey that in the character as you go along. You don't want them to be too big out front. You have to figure out what the characters are going to sound like, especially if you find the two of them are talking to each other a lot. You want to make sure that you don't give them voices that are identical or it's tough for the listener.
Right.
And you just have to watch out for surprises. Sometimes something's revealed partway into the book. You don't want to be on page 200 of a Zane Grey Western and hear something like, well, it was great to help all you folks out here, but I got to get back to my ranch in County Cork, Ireland. Oh, crap.
Right, you have to know what you're doing. Well, give us some examples of some books you've done.
The most recent was one of the most challenging. It was a 1,000-and-something page work of a nonfiction called The History of Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. And, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, there's a special feeling to, like, reading page one and then looking and the other 1,023 pages to go, but you just kind of walk through it.
So what were some of the challenges with that?
With that, you have to be careful to keep your energy up from day to day because a project that long keeps you recording for a long time. If you were to start listening to the book now, it would take you 46 and a half hours to hear the whole thing.
How long did it take you to record it?
About 3 months. So I was nice and busy for 3 months, but it also went a little bit slower than your average book because the history of Christianity went all over the world, so there were names from everywhere. And when you're reading for fun, if you get to a name like Ali ibn Ali Bakr al-Harawi, you can just kind of go, you know, and it doesn't matter. But if you're reading it out loud, you have to go and find out how to say that. And every other German and Russian and French and Spanish and Portuguese and Korean, Japanese, Chinese name that's in there and make sure you get it right. I had 81 pages of things to pronounce from that. And on this
81 pages?
Yeah. About 1,000 names and places. Most of them Latin. I really wish I'd taken Latin in high school.
Well, back up a bit and tell us, how'd you come to get involved in this?
The short version, always was interested in audio and radio and theater and comedy and music and whatnot, and this finally is the way that I've been able to bring all that together. Because to be a narrator, you have to either be close to a recording studio that'll record you, or you have to set up your own and do all the production yourself. So that's right. The situation I'm in. I record it and then edit it and mix it and send it out.
Form relationships with publishing companies and then the books land in your lap.
Yeah, after everybody saying no for about 2 years, because a lot of the publishers are small. It's a big risk to pick up somebody new. I started with the Library of Congress and then found some other publishers willing to take a chance at the beginning. And there are a lot of places where you can read books for the blind. It saves you a lot of trouble when the rest of the work comes along. If you've been able to work out whatever problems you have, doing stuff for books for the blind and whatnot, where because they're not paying you, they're just happy you're there to read for them. That can give you a real edge.
Well, few people have made big names for themselves in this business, but one man stands out. That's mm-hmm. Jim Dale. He's the fellow who narrates all the Harry Potter books.
Sure.
Let's first play a clip. This is from Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, the fourth book in the series. In this scene, Harry is in a tense battle with his arch nemesis, the evil Voldemort.
We are not playing hide and seek, Harry, said Voldemort's soft, cold voice, drawing nearer as the Death Eaters laughed. You cannot hide from me. Does this mean you are tired of our duel? Does this mean that you would prefer me to finish it now, Harry? Come out, Harry. Come out and play. Then it will be quick. It might even be painless. I would not know. I have never died.
Oh, that's great.
Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just so good. In fact, Jim Dale won a Grammy Award for that performance in 2001, and he's not, you know, he would consider himself a book narrator, I think.
He is with a theater background. It's very common for folks in the business to have that. And who could listen to that, even if he's not currently performing on the stage, and deny that this is clearly an actor that's doing this, that really has an ear for the character and figuring out how to really get inside of it.
So how do you, who's not an actor but has some love of theater and the arts and radio and everything, how would you approach a children's book? I know you have some examples.
You sort of read through it, look at the language, because that's the key into what the character is. What are they doing and what do they say and how do they say it? You can tell pretty quickly if you've come up with a voice that just isn't working for the character.
Now, I know you have an example there.
Yeah, this is from a kid's book called Freddy to the Rescue, and it's an exchange between a fussy little hamster and a cat. The hamster, Freddy, has just heard someone crying for help, and he's trying to get the cat to help him.
Oh, my.
"Sir William," I said, "I heard a cry just now, a desperate cry for help in Interanimal. I thought you must have heard it, too." He looked at me.
"Freddy, if that were the case, do you think I'd have remained lying here on my blanket, quietly meditating?" "No, your lordship," I said to myself. "Not unless you were sound asleep and meditating in your dreams."
Sir William smiled indulgently. He yawned.
"And now, my dear fellow, permit me to resume my cogitations."
He closed his eyes and instantly fell asleep.
What fun. I mean, what fun.
The kids' books are, because it's the one time that you're allowed to really just go nuts with the character voices and be really dramatic and chew it up.
Well, what kind of advice would you give other people if they think, I want to try this? You've already said it helps if you can have your own production studio and no production as you did before you started. But what else?
You have to have a special kind of demo for audiobooks. It's not like a voiceover demo where they want to hear 30 seconds because they want to know if you can be interesting for 5 minutes or 5 hours. Persistence is important. Finding out who the publishers are and keeping at them. Because sooner or later, you're going to call somebody who's in a hurry and just needs someone, and they're going to take a risk, and it'll be on you. And there you go.
Walter Dixon, he's a colleague of ours here at our home station, the mothership, WBUR here in Boston. Also, quite an audiobook narrator. Walter, thanks for telling us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun.